To the Chris Business Hour from the Bear Cave. I'm Barry Slater, and today we will focus on the top stories from around the world, the nation, and the state. Starting off with this week's Hartford Business Journal, we have an article written by Andrew Larson. It's titled, New Milford Printing Expands with Acquisition of J&J Printing. A family-owned New Milford print shop has acquired another print shop in town. New Milford Printing, owned by Boros Company, LLC, controlled by Gary and Patty Boros of Monroe, purchased Barron Printing, LLC, which does business as J&J Printing, on June 3rd, the companies announced. J&J Printing, located in the north end of town at 11 Howland Road, has been owned and operated by New Milford resident Sherry Barron since 2007. New Milford Printing has been in business for more than 40 years and is located at 221 Danbury Road, also known as Route 7, in the south end of town. I look forward to welcoming J&J's customers to our printing family, said Gary Boros, co-owner of New Milford Printing, adding, We're excited to establish relationships with them and fulfill their printing needs seamlessly. New Milford Printing said it will continue working with Barron for a few months to ensure a smooth transition. New Milford Printing provides a variety of services, including design, printing, finishing, and mailing. The business produces booklets, publications, business stationery, letterhead, forms, notepads, postcards, greeting cards, and marketing materials. It primarily serves customers in Litchfield, Fairfield, and New Haven counties, but its biggest client is the U.S. military. New Milford Printing, the sole printer for the military's coupon program, prints and mails 1 million coupons a month to bases around the globe for use at commissaries. In addition, it makes the signs and displays for the commissaries. The Boros family owns and operates three other businesses in New Milford, Lace and Ink, which specializes in custom printing and accessories for weddings and special events, Signworks Studios, LLC, a custom sign company that produces carved, dimensional, and illuminated signs, sculpted concrete, vehicle wraps, and banners, and Northeast Aquatraction, which offers marine flooring. Gary Boros's wife, Patty, is a graphic art designer. Their son, Brett, and daughters, Tara and Kate, are all involved with the family businesses. The Boroses bought New Milford Printing in 2011. Next, from this week's Hartford Business Journal, an article written by Hannah Snyder Gambini is titled, CorBev Launches New Connecticut Distilling Headquarters in Waterbury. Connecticut-based alcohol manufacturer CorBev said it is opening a new craft distillery in Waterbury. Connecticut Distilling will serve as the new manufacturing hub for all domestic legacy CorBev products and feature a tasting lounge for craft cocktails. It will produce a range of premium craft spirits, including five new products like a charred whiskey and Drops Clear Floral Spirit, both made from beer, Fort Hill Bourbon, Waterville Vodka, and a blueberry rum made by resting Connecticut blueberries in rum for 2 months, according to CorBev founder Stelios Stavrianos. Connecticut Distilling will be located at 2066 Thomaston Avenue, which was the home of Waterbury-based Continuum Distilling before it was acquired by CorBev earlier this year. CorBev's Connecticut Distilling is a culmination of the former Continuum Distilling and the Cocktail Chemist Bev Company, founded by Dimitrios Zaharadis. Continuum Distilling was launched in early 2020 by Brandon Collins, who remains the company's master distiller. Continuum was acquired by CorBev for $1 million in early 2024. Also part of the team is Connecticut Distilling's manager, Zachariadis, who founded the cocktail chemist Bev Company that was acquired by CorBev in late 2021. Next, an article written by Hannah Snyder Gambini. It's titled, New Penske Trucking Facility Coming to East Windsor. Bloomfield-based PDS Engineering will build a new multi-building trucking facility in East Windsor for the Penske Rental Commercial Truck Company. PDS President Bill Jodis said construction started last week on phase one of the multi-million dollar project, which includes a 40,000 square foot building to be used primarily for mechanical and maintenance work on Penske's fleet of trucks, along with truck parking. A second, smaller building, around 16,000 square feet, will be built during phase two, also with maintenance and repair facilities, along with office space. The new facility sits on 18 acres of vacant farmland at 9 Craftsman Road and 74 Newberry Road that Penske purchased 4 years ago, anticipating company growth and the need for new space. Jodis said the parcel is ideal for the company's expansion plans since it's under a mile to Interstate 91 with easy access to Hartford, Massachusetts, and other highways in Connecticut. The Reading, Pennsylvania commercial truck rental company has more than 2,500 locations throughout the United States and Canada. Penske recently opened new leasing facilities in New Jersey, Florida, California, and Washington, and announced a new online reservations system for customers launched earlier this month. Next, from the Hartford Business Journal, an article written by David Krzyzewski. It's titled, Construction Hasn't Started, But West Hartford Luxury Apartments Are Already Selling. There is so much interest in living in West Hartford Center that people are willing to pay more than $1 million for the privilege. Center Park Place, a mixed-use residential and commercial infill development to be constructed at Arapahoe and LaSalle Roads in Farmington Avenue, will feature up to 58 luxury condominiums that are already listed for sale at more than $1 million. An infill development repurposes land in an urban environment. The project includes demolishing two buildings and erecting two new buildings. One of the new buildings will have four residential floors over three levels of parking, including one underground. That building will be located in the center of the property, behind 53 to 65 and 27 to 43 LaSalle Road and 1001 Farmington Avenue. The development also will include a five-story building with 25 units of rental housing on the top four floors and 3,470 square feet of commercial space on the ground floor. One of the conditions of approval for the development set by the West Hartford Town Council states that the second building will include four residential rental units designed as affordable for individuals or families with incomes at or below 80% of the area median income for the town. The project will demolish two small buildings at 8 and 12 Arapahoe Road, but the large office and commercial buildings at 27 to 43 and 53 to 65 LaSalle Road and at 1001 Farmington Avenue will remain. Condo unit configurations will range from one bedroom to three bedroom layouts, with prices ranging from $1.2 million to $1.8 million. Because construction has not started, buyers have the option to purchase two or more units and combine them. The unit listings, posted by Coldwell Banker Realty, went live on May 23rd and have already drawn significant interest According to Agent Kate Diodabo, we have 12 units under reserve, she said recently, adding that 46 units remain available. You can do a 30-day reservation, and then we would deliver a contract in 30 days. She declines to disclose sale prices because no sales have yet closed. Diodabo said the demand reflects the desire of some homeowners to sell their homes but remain in town and be more centrally located, while also a sign that others who live outside of West Hartford are interested as well. I think a lot of people are really turning towards walkability and being close to town center, she said, adding it's a healthy lifestyle, just being able to walk everywhere, which I think is a huge reason that West Hartford is very popular because it's becoming more and more pedestrian friendly all around town. Diodabo described the project as a Class A building designed to be not only luxurious but offering many amenities. Those include secure parking, a lobby with a concierge, a community pool deck, a gym, and a roof deck. One of the developers of the project is Mark Lewis, the principal managing member of Lexham Realty Management based in Westport. Lexham owns the properties at 53 to 65 LaSalle Road, 27 to 43 LaSalle Road, and 1001 Farmington Avenue. Another parcel at 12 Arapaho Road is owned by the Arapaho Group, LLC. In addition to Lexham and the Arapaho Group, developers involved in the project include the Manafort family and Figure 8 Properties, which was founded by the late Robert Simmons and is operated by his sons, Bruce and Harris. Next up from this week's Hartford Business Journal, an article written by Andrew Larson titled, Pratt & Whitney proposes nearly 50% increase in size of new East Hartford office building. Pratt & Whitney is proposing to increase the size of a new planned office building on its East Hartford campus by nearly 50%, with the addition of two stories, including outdoor amenities for employees and green space. The jet engine maker has submitted a revised zoning application to the town, which is on the agenda for the Planning and Zoning Commission's meeting at 7 p.m. on Wednesday. A spokesman for Pratt & Whitney's parent company, RTX, said the zoning application does not signal any commitment to build the new office, but is a required step as it reviews and considers real estate options. We continually assess our Connecticut campus and options to improve on our current footprint to meet the needs of our business, the company's statement said. Pratt & Whitney originally received approval for a 313,000-square-foot building with five stories. The new plan calls for a 465,000-square-foot building with seven stories. The seventh story includes outdoor amenity areas for employees, including a patio and vegetated green roof. The footprint of the building will not change. Under the proposal, an existing 249,847-square-foot office building, which houses design and engineering staff, will be demolished to make way for the new building and an adjacent employee parking lot. Under the original proposal, the parking lot contained 1,347 spaces. The new plans show 1,458 parking spaces. The increased size of the office building would not require any changes in the grading, drainage, utilities, lighting, or landscaping from the original approval, the application states. The original plan had a net gain of 63,143 square feet of office space, but the project now would result in a net increase of 215,143 square feet of office space at the Pratt & Whitney's 251.28-acre campus. The new building is located on a 17.75-acre portion of the campus near Runway Road, which runs along the eastern outskirts of the property. Pratt & Whitney is asking the town for zoning approval of the site plan modification. The company has been redeveloping its East Hartford campus, which once spanned more than 1,000 acres, for years. In 2014, Pratt & Whitney's parent company, United Technologies Corp., which is now known as RTX Corporation, following its 2020 merger with Raytheon Technologies, agreed to invest up to $500 million over 5 years to upgrade and expand its East Hartford research and development and manufacturing facilities. Well, you're listening to the Chris Business Hour. I'm Barry Slater. I'll be back with more after this break.
For the past 130 years, Oak Hill has served thousands of people in Connecticut. We offer a variety of programs such as Oak Hill School. Oak Hill School is a private, state-approved special education program for students ages 3 to 22. With classrooms across Connecticut, Oak Hill School provides an individualized, community-based program focused on building confidence and promoting independence. Oak Hill School, empowering people with disabilities. To find out more, visit oakhillct.org.
Next up, from the Hartford Business Journal, an article written by Mark Pazniakis and Erica Phillips is titled, Over GOP Objections, the Senate Passes Aquarian Measure. The state Senate Democratic majority crushed Republican efforts Wednesday to slow passage of an unvetted proposal allowing a New Haven-based public water authority to acquire one of the nation's largest investor-owned water companies, Aquarian Water Company. On a 20-9 party-line vote, the Senate passed a 137-page omnibus bill in a special session originally envisioned primarily as a means to rectify a motor vehicle taxing problem left over from the regular season, but eventually included an Aquarian issue that came as an 11th-hour surprise. The House is to vote on the bill on Thursday. The largest section of the bill would enable the South Central Connecticut Regional Water Authority to bid for Aquarian and, if successful, create an Aquarian Water Authority that would oversee and set rates for a supplier of water to nearly 60 of Connecticut's 169 cities and towns. This stinks. It might be the right policy. I just don't know yet, said Senator Ryan Fazio, a Republican from Greenwich, saying, we've had 2 days to analyze 50 pages of a policy change which have an economic effect of billions of dollars without any sort of substantial input from experts, from the agencies, or from the regulators. The Connecticut Mirror reported Friday that Aquarian would be an element of the special session call that Governor Ned Lamont would issue the next day, a surprise to lawmakers. The authority's interest in purchasing Aquarian had not been previously reported. Senate President Pro Tem Martin Looney, a Democrat of New Haven, said the action was timely since Eversource Energy, which purchased Aquarian in 2017, could sell the subsidiary before the General Assembly's next regular session in January of 2025. He and Senator John Fanfara, a Democrat of Hartford, who explained the bill, noted that it simply allowed a bid and that regulators would have final say over a sale. But the Regional Water Authority operates outside the jurisdiction of state regulators, and lawmakers questioned what a purchase could mean to the finances of the Water Authority or the rates of a combined RWA Aquarian system. Fazio, the ranking Republican on the legislative committee that would have reviewed the legislation if proposed in regular session, said data at the Office of Consumer Counsel showed that the Aquarian's regulated rates were lower than those of the RWA. It was not given any public vetting, any major public debate or analysis, Fazio said. And so I submit to you that no one knows what the consequences of what we're voting on will be, he added. Senate Minority Leader Stephen Harding Jr., a Republican from Brookfield, and his staff approached Looney and his staff in the Senate chamber before the session opened to ask, at the least, for a separate vote on the Aquarian provision as a standalone bill. Democrats refused, and they later defeated a motion to divide the bill and an amendment that would have struck the provision from the omnibus measure. I'm very happy that I'm going to support this amendment so that I can make it clear to my constituents that I don't want my fingerprints on this thing at all. I do not want to be within 1,000 miles of this bit of legislation because I think this is a bad, bad set of terms to make a huge change in the way these consumers are going to purchase their water, said Senator Rob Sampson, a Republican from Woolpit. Democrats largely ignored the Republican objections in debate. There was broad support for other portions of the bill. Without the car tax fix, motor vehicles could have seen a tax increase in October. The fix would continue to classify commercial vehicles as motor vehicles, and it would clarify that current law allows municipalities to establish mill rates on motor vehicles that are lower than mill rates on real property and personal property. Another component of the bill lays out new rules and timelines for the State Historic Preservation Office's evaluation of state-funded redevelopment projects. SHPO sits within the Department of Economic and Community Development, but currently has very little oversight, leaders of the legislature's Commerce Committee said. Under the new law, SHPO would have just 30 days to make an initial determination of a project's impact on historic structures and landmarks, and if possible, propose a feasible alternative the developer could pursue to avoid the impact. Next up, from the Hartford Business Journal, an article written by Andrew Larson titled, "Wynn Companies Acquires 84-Unit Hartford Apartment Building, Plans $18.7 Million Upgrade." Boston-based developer Wynn Companies has acquired Bedford Garden Apartments in the Clay Arsenal neighborhood of Hartford, the company announced on Tuesday. Bedford Gardens contains 84 apartments in 10 three-story residential buildings. The purchase price was not disclosed. Now, the company's development arm, Wynn Development, plans to begin an $18.7 million effort to renovate the apartment buildings, which were built in the 1920s. When finished, the community will be renamed Claystone Commons. The renovations include upgrading the brick exteriors, installing new roofs, balconies, windows, HVAC systems, kitchen cabinets, appliances, bathroom fixtures, and security features, adding on-site laundry facilities and a property management office, and creating 9 fully handicapped accessible units. The work will occur in phases, allowing some residents to remain while construction occurs. Resident relocations will be coordinated by Boston-based Housing to Home. The renovations should be finished in June of 2025, the company said. "We are excited for the opportunity to preserve the affordability of this landmark property for decades to come and to make long-term capital upgrades that will improve the quality of life for current and future residents," said Wynn Development Executive Vice President Adam Stein. Several entities are helping to finance the project, including the Connecticut Housing Finance Authority, which is issuing tax-exempt bond financing and providing the construction and permanent mortgage, as well as a soft loan. According to the State Department of Housing, all units will be designated as affordable to households who earn at or below 60% area median income. DOH is providing $4 million for the development, while Connecticut Housing Finance Authority is investing $3.89 million in financing, as well as 4% low-income housing tax credits that will generate $8.6 million in private equity. To prepare for the project, wind development worked with the city of Hartford and a Rhode Island-based consultant to place Bedford Gardens on the National Register of Historic Places. The acquisition marks the 9th apartment community owned by wind companies in Connecticut. The company's property management arm, Wynn Residential, operates 20 other Connecticut apartment properties on behalf of private or nonprofit owners. Next, from this week's Hartford Business Journal, an article written by Hannah Snyder Gambini. It's titled, State Funding to Help Create Hundreds of Affordable Housing Units Across Connecticut. Several housing developments throughout Connecticut will receive funding to create hundreds of affordable units. The State Department of Housing and the Connecticut Housing Finance Authority this week signed financing agreements for 9 developments that will contribute to the creation of 722 housing units, including 651 affordable for low and moderate income renters. Additionally, 82 of the units will be designated as permanent housing for people experiencing homelessness and those with disabilities, the state agencies said. Developments are located in Hartford, Meriden, New Britain, New Haven, Plainville, Waterbury, and Haddam. DOH is providing more than $57 million in loans and grants, and CHFA is providing an additional $51.6 million in financing, as well as low-income housing tax credits that will generate more than $97.7 million in private investment. The affordable units will be earmarked for residents making between 25 and 80% of the area median income. CHFA signed a financing agreement for 44 units to be funded by the Build for Connecticut program, a new collaboration between DOH and CHFA to support the creation of apartments designed to be affordable for middle-income renters. The developments are now ready to begin construction as financing is in place. Next, from the Hartford Business Journal, an article written by Greg Bordenaro titled, Stamford Health to Expand Presence in Home Cities Long Ridge Corridor. Stamford Health, the nonprofit health system that owns Stamford Hospital, has signed a new long-term lease in its home city. The health network, which also owns urgent care and physician group practices, signed a lease for 65,667 square feet of office and medical space at 260 Long Ridge Road, a 197,000 square foot building owned by Stamford-based developer and landlord Building and Land Technology. Stamford Health also currently occupies 46,392 square feet at 292 Long Ridge Road and a nearby 54,000 square foot building that is part of the larger Long Ridge Corridor, which is positioning itself as a healthcare hub. The building at 260 Long Ridge Road is also home to Greenwich Hospital and Yale New Haven Medical Group. Dermatology Physicians of Connecticut signed a 5,625 square foot lease at the building this past September, according to the landlord. Stamford Health Chief Operating Officer Liz Longmore said the health system will open space at 260 Long Ridge Road in phases, starting with 30,000 square feet debuting in late 2025. The first phase will include relocating some existing outpatient and medical specialty services from other locations so that we can provide more appointment availability and hire additional physicians and advanced practice providers to care for our patients. In addition to the opening of multiple retail and dining establishments, including Starbucks, Shake Shack, and Frank Pepe Pizzeria Napoletana, the Long Ridge Road corridor will also soon see the debut of a new Whole Foods and the development of the Mosaic Senior Living Complex Building and Land Technology. Stanford Health, which only owns one hospital in fiscal 2022, reported $832 million in operating revenue and a $37.9 million operating deficit, according to its most recent financial data published by the Office of Health Strategy. We'll now move on to the Thursday, June 27th, New York Times, starting off with the Business Roundup. First article in the Roundup, a debate cheat sheet for business. All eyes will be on CNN at 9 p.m. Eastern when President Biden and Donald Trump will face off in their first debate since 2020. Among the keenest watchers will be executives and investors looking for signs about how the candidates might handle the economy and business in a second term. There will be plenty to scrutinize in a 90-minute audience-free debate, including what the candidates say and how they say it. Here's what we will be looking out for. The economy is the big question. Various measures show strong growth under Biden, but many voters feel differently. What will Biden and Trump say about some of the key issues? Inflation. This is clearly a challenge for the president as Americans complain about what they're paying in the grocery store, at the pump, and on their rent. Biden can say that price increases are slowing down and will most likely emphasize his administration's efforts to crack down on corporate greed, like taking on so-called junk fees. Trump will probably stress how good things were when he took office in 2017, an economy many Americans want back. Next, taxes. Biden's proposals for higher corporate taxes will hit profits. It's simple math. David Bonson, the founder and chief investment officer of the Bonson Group, told DealBook. Many business leaders don't like Biden's plan to increase taxes on the wealthy either. Trump will probably stress his desire to extend his 2017 tax cuts and lower the corporate rate to 20%, but questions about corporate earnings and the economy may eclipse those concerns. Next, protectionism. Both candidates want to increase tariffs on Chinese goods, but Biden has been more targeted in how he has done it during his presidency. Trump has proposed significantly higher across-the-board levies, though it's unclear how serious he is about it. Economists have warned that Trump's potential approach could aggravate inflation and hurt the economy. Next, the markets. The S&P 500 set 31 records this year. Investors will hope neither party messes with that momentum. In Thursday night's debate, markets probably care more about presentation than policy pledges, Paul Donovan, an economist at UBS, wrote in a client note. Biden may have a slight edge, he added, since investors would prefer keeping some continuity. Other issues will probably feature prominently. Biden will most likely raise abortion rights, a topic that has helped Democrats win in recent elections. Trump will almost certainly speak a lot about immigration, perhaps his most potent issue, and one that many, including Elon Musk, say is a failure of Biden's. The intangibles will matter. Executives told DealBook that CEOs will be paying attention to how Biden and Trump perform. For Biden, 81 years old, an important issue for business leaders and many voters is whether he is still fit to serve. A sharp, forceful performance could go a ways in quieting any concerns. And for the 78-year-old Mr. Trump, competence is a question as well. But his demeanor will also be under scrutiny, especially if he comes across as overly abrasive or erratic. Some executives said their feelings would come down to whether they can stomach another 4 years of a Trump presidency. And there's also the show around the show. Trump has suggested that his potential running mate would be in Atlanta for the debate. The Times reports that his list is narrowing with Senator J.D. Vance of Ohio, Governor Doug Burgum of North Dakota, and Senator Marco Rubio of Florida being of particular interest. The pick may matter a great deal to Trump's campaign. The Republican megadonor Ken Griffin has said the choice could influence whether he opens up his wallet for Trump. Now, four short business happenings. First, the Fed gives America's biggest lenders a clean bill of health. The central bank's latest stress tests show that major institutions could survive even extreme economic conditions, including a plunge in the value of the dollar and the collapse of their biggest clients. The results may strengthen banks' arguments that capital requirements should not be raised as regulators plan on doing. And SpaceX reportedly plans to sell shares at a nearly $210 billion valuation. Elon Musk's rocket company raised its valuation, which is up 16% from December, in the tender offer after stronger-than-expected investor demand, according to Bloomberg. That level sets a record for a privately held American startup and trails only the $268 billion of ByteDance, the Chinese owner of TikTok. Next, Boeing faces accusations from another whistleblower. A subcontractor who worked on the 787 Dreamliner said he faced retaliation after pointing out what he said were substandard manufacturing and maintenance practices. Separately, Boeing said it had achieved significant quality improvements in the production of the 737 MAX after one such plane lost a panel during a flight in January. And Amazon joins the $2 trillion club. The tech giant is now in the company of Alphabet, Apple, Microsoft, and Nvidia as investors bet on its efforts to capitalize on the artificial intelligence boom and its cost-cutting efforts. Separately, Amazon is reportedly planning to compete with low-cost rivals by introducing a Temu-esque service that ships cheap goods directly from China, according to the information. Well, the next article in the Business Roundup is a question. A welcome cool down? A late winter rise in inflation appears to have cooled off this spring. A key data point set to be released on Friday will confirm whether this trend has held up and what that might mean for interest rates. S&P 500 futures were trading slightly lower this morning after a small gain on Wednesday as investors await the Personal Consumption Expenditures Price Index, the Fed's preferred inflation measure. Economists expect to see an improvement in May PCE numbers. That would be notable given that a lower-than-expected Consumer Price Index report this month also suggested that the Fed's interest rate policy was stifling demand and suppressing inflation. Here's what to watch for. Core PCE, which excludes volatile food and fuel prices, is forecast to come in at 2.6% on an annualized basis. That would be 0.2 percentage points lower than April's reading, but still above the Fed's 2% target. And analysts will look for signs that so-called shelter inflation, which tracks housing, is easing. There's still tightness in the market, but there are also indications that prospective home buyers are putting off purchases as mortgage rates are sky high. Consumer goods prices have edged lower over the year, a trend that is expected to be confirmed in the report. One example, last week's retail sales report showed that consumers were pulling back, underscoring what companies like Target, Walmart, and Kohl's have said about their lower-income customers. And services inflation could be a wild card. Economists are seeing evidence that demand for airfares, hotels, and restaurant bookings are not growing at the torrid pace of a year ago. But the summer travel season has only just begun, and Carnival, the cruise ship operator, this week reported strong results and an upbeat outlook. A cool reading could lift the stock market. Wall Street is divided over whether the Fed will join other central banks in lowering borrowing costs. Futures traders are pricing in a roughly 60% chance of a September cut, but Fed officials say they need more evidence that consumer prices are in retreat before taking action. Next article in the Business Roundup, Big Tech wins in court. The Supreme Court just gave the Biden administration and Big Tech another legal victory, rejecting a lawsuit that had accused government officials of pressuring social media companies to censor conservative content. It was one of several cases that could have big consequences for how tech giants are regulated. So how did we get here? Biden administration officials had urged social media companies like Facebook and X, then called Twitter, to remove what it said was misinformation on COVID-19 vaccines and claims of election fraud related to the 2020 contest. In 2022, the attorneys general of Louisiana and Missouri, both Republicans, along with three doctors and a right-wing website that traffics in conspiracy theories, accused the government of coercing the companies to muzzle conservative content. Last year, a Trump-appointed judge in Louisiana ruled against the administration, issuing an injunction that limited government communications with social media companies about content. The Supreme Court disagreed. In a 6-3 ruling, the majority said the plaintiffs have failed to prove harm. They also rejected the censorship claims outright, saying that the companies acted on their own. Justices expressed unease about how the executive branch communicates. From the majority opinion, written by Justice Amy Coney Barrett, the plaintiffs, without any concrete link between their injuries and the defendant's conduct, ask us to conduct a review of the years-long communications between dozens of federal officials across different agencies with different social media platforms about different topics. The court's standing doctrine prevents us from exercising such general legal oversight of the other branches of government. It's the latest Supreme Court ruling on how big tech polices content. Last year, the court rejected two cases that would have limited the scope of Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. That measure gives companies immunity for user content posted on their sites and allows them to remove information they deem offensive. Big Tech says it is crucial to the open internet. Critics counter that Section 230 has been wrongly used to shield the companies from legal claims. So what's next? The Supreme Court is expected to rule on a separate social media case about laws in Florida and Texas that limit social media companies' ability to delete conservative content. Justices have already expressed wariness about the state laws. So they've included a debate bingo card at the end of the business roundup. I know the first time you'll hear this is the morning after the debate. Well, let's see how you scored. So those that tuned in will hear plenty about policy age and consumer prices. Here's some of the terms, references, and zingers that we may have heard. Shrinkflation. President Biden brought his reduced packaging gripe to Americans around this year's Super Bowl. And crypto. Donald Trump has courted the industry, which has benefited from an impressive rally this year, and is determined to knock off crypto-skeptic candidates. And inflation nightmare. That's how Trump has summed up the issue, pinning the blame squarely on his opponent and Nobel Prize. Biden got a strong endorsement this week from 16 Nobel Prize-winning economists who have warned that Trumponomics could lead to Trumpflation. Well, you're listening to the Chris Business Hour. I'll be back with the final segment of this week's show after this break.
The American School for the Deaf recently launched their Lost in Translation campaign to raise awareness around communications accessibility challenges experienced among the deaf, hard of hearing, and deaf-blind communities in Connecticut, especially in areas of healthcare and education. Through this project, the American School for the Deaf will work with hospital and education systems to identify areas of need and provide solutions to ensure deaf, hard of hearing, and deaf-blind citizens have full communication access during the most critical times of their lives. For more information, visit their website, asd-1817.org. The American School for the Deaf, always able.
And welcome back to the final segment of this week's Chris Business Hour. Next up from the Thursday, June 27th, New York Times business section, an article written by Alan Rappaport titled, Rampant Identity Theft is Taxing the IRS. Rampant identity theft has overwhelmed the Internal Revenue Service, resulting in a backlog of 500,000 unresolved fraud cases, leaving taxpayers without refunds and credits that they are due, the agency's watchdog wrote in a report to Congress on Wednesday. The report by the National Taxpayer Advocate described the slow pace of addressing the identity theft cases as a blemish on the performance of the IRS, which is in the midst of a sweeping modernization campaign that aims to improve taxpayer services. While the IRS was criticized by the watchdog for identity theft delays last year, the backlog has gotten only worse. The IRS is taking nearly 2 years to resolve identity theft victims' assistance cases and has an inventory of approximately 500,000 cases, up from 484,000 cases in September. IRS delays in resolving identity theft victim assistance cases are unconscionable, Aaron Collins, the taxpayer advocate, wrote in the report. Calling on the agency to prioritize assistance for victims, she added, delays of nearly 2 years make a mockery of the right to quality service in the taxpayer Bill of Rights. The backlog of cases is likely to give congressional Republicans more fodder to criticize the IRS and to call for cleaving back more of the $80 billion in funding that the agency received through the Inflation Reduction Act of 2022. Sure, make it 4 years. Critics of the agency have been arguing that it is bloated and failing to put that money to good use. The IRS said in a statement that it recognizes that the backlog of identity theft cases remains one of its most significant ongoing service gaps and that it is working to implement a range of improvements to provide faster service to victims. That includes training and directing more staff to work on the cases, a spokesman for the agency said. Identity theft has long been a problem for the IRS. Criminals often steal taxpayers' identifying information and file paperwork to fraudulently claim their refund. Taxpayers realize this only when they try to claim their refund, leading to a laborious process in which they have to submit an identity theft affidavit and a paper tax return before the agency will open a case to investigate the matter. At that point, the victims of identity theft are left waiting for months before they can receive the money that they are owed. The National Taxpayer Advocate said that most victims of identity theft were on the lower end of the income scale and often needed their refunds and refundable tax credits to pay their living expenses. The IRS is re-victimizing taxpayers by making them wait nearly 2 years to resolve their case and receive their refund, the report said. The report said that the problem was in part attributable to the agency's redirecting resources aimed at improving its metrics that demonstrate how efficiently calls are being answered. However, the watchdog said that the IRS was using an outdated methodology to track how quickly it answered calls and that most callers were disconnected or routed to automated operators. Despite the criticism, the watchdog noted that the IRS was dedicating more staff to deal with identity fraud cases and that the 2024 tax filing season overall went smoothly. The IRS was originally given $80 billion to upgrade its technology and enforcement abilities, but Congress clawed back approximately $20 billion of those funds last year during a spending fight between Republicans and Democrats. A report published last week by the Treasury Inspector General for Tax Administration said that the IRS has so far spent $5.7 billion, or 10% of its Inflation Reduction Act funding. About $2 billion of that money, however, was spent on normal operating expenses that the IRS did not have sufficient resources to cover. Next, from the New York Times, an article written by Jack Ewing. Its title, Volkswagen Will Invest Up to $5 Billion in Rivian. Volkswagen, the German automaker, said on Tuesday that it would invest up to $5 billion in Rivian, a maker of electric trucks that has struggled to turn a profit, and that the companies would cooperate on software for electric vehicles. The deal creates an unusual alliance between the world's second-largest car maker and an electric vehicle startup that has strained to live up to investors' expectations that it would achieve the kind of success that made Tesla the world's most valuable automaker. If successful, the partnership would address weaknesses at both companies. It would provide Volkswagen with the software expertise that auto analysts say it sorely lacks. And Rivian, in addition to cash, would benefit from the manufacturing expertise of an automaker that produces nearly 10 million vehicles a year, putting it just behind Toyota Motor in the global auto industry. Volkswagen said it would initially invest $1 billion in Rivian and over time increase that to as much as $5 billion. If regulators approve the transaction, Volkswagen could become a significant shareholder. The infusion represents a big vote of confidence in Rivian, which loses tens of thousands of dollars on each vehicle it sells. Rivian's pickups and sport utility vehicles have received glowing reviews in the automotive press, but the company has struggled to ramp up manufacturing at its factory in Normal, Illinois. In recent months, many investors have grown worried that the company may not survive long enough to become profitable. R.J. Scaringe, Rivian's founder and chief executive, said the cash from Volkswagen would help Rivian launch a midsize SUV called the R2 that will sell for about $45,000 and to complete a factory in Georgia. Rivian halted construction of the Georgia plant in March in an effort to save more than $2 billion. This is important for us financially, Mr. Scaringe said of the Volkswagen partnership on a conference call with reporters on Tuesday. The cheapest vehicle Rivian currently sells, the R1T pickup, starts around $70,000, a price that has limited its sales to affluent early adopters. Its R1S SUV starts at $75,000. Even at those prices, Rivian lost $39,000 for every vehicle it sold in the first 3 months of the year. Rivian stock jumped more than 50% in extended trading on Tuesday after the deal was announced. The electric vehicle market has been divided between relatively young companies like Tesla and Rivian, which make only battery-powered cars, and established car makers like Volkswagen, General Motors, and Toyota, which have often struggled to master the new technology. Except for Tesla, none of the newer U.S. car makers specializing in electric vehicles have won significant market share. Some, like Fisker and Lordstown Motors, have ceased production and filed for bankruptcy protection. Auto analysts have long considered Rivian among the electric vehicle startups most likely to survive, in part because it has raised billions of dollars in investment. Amazon is one of its largest shareholders and the main customer for the company's delivery vans. But Volkswagen and Rivian operate very differently, and it could be a challenge for them to work together. Volkswagen, which is based in Wolfsburg, Germany, is known for rigid, top-down management and is owned in part by the state of Lower Saxony. Rivian, based in Irvine, California, has the more freewheeling culture of a technology startup. Rivian said in April that it expected to sell 57,000 vehicles this year, far fewer than Volkswagen sells in a week. Mr. Scheringe and Oliver Blum, the chief executive of Volkswagen, said the deal blossomed after the two met at a Porsche customer center and bonded over their love of cars. "We have a very similar mindset," Mr. Blum said during the conference call. Ford Motor was for a time a big shareholder in Rivian, and the two companies once said they would build SUVs together. But that plan never came to fruition, and Ford sold most of its Rivian shares. Ford and Volkswagen have a separate partnership that includes joint development and production of electric vehicles. The Volkswagen-Rivian alliance could encourage other established car makers to consider investments or partnerships connecting them with startups like Lucid Motors, companies that have well-regarded technology but are unprofitable and struggling to establish themselves in a crowded market. Another large automaker, Stellantis, the parent company of Chrysler, Fiat, and Peugeot, has invested in a Chinese company, Leap Motor, for access to its electric car technology. Vehicles using the software developed by the new joint venture will go on sale during the second half of the decade, Volkswagen said. Any of Volkswagen's brands, which include Audi and Porsche, could use the technology, Mr. Blum said. Scout, the American off-road brand that Volkswagen is reviving at a factory under construction in South Carolina, could also use the software. But Volkswagen and Rivian will continue to market their vehicles separately. And a short article to round out the show, and this is from the Hartford Business Journal. It's written by David Krzyzewski, entitled, "UConn Health Expects to Record $1 Billion in Patient Revenue in Fiscal Year 25 and Projected Deficit Eliminated." UConn Health said Wednesday it expects to generate record-setting revenue of more than $1 billion in the coming fiscal year. The Farmington-based health system said the revenue from its hospital and clinical operations in fiscal 25 would represent a 133% increase in just the past 10 years. The projected net patient revenue figure is included in the proposed fiscal year 25 spending plan that the Board of Trustees adopted Wednesday in stores. In addition to projecting net patient revenue of $1.003 billion The plan also shows that a budgeted $25.6 million loss has been eliminated. A year-end forecast for fiscal 2024 that is included in the budget presentation also shows that budget breaking even instead of an expected $10.1 million in net income. UConn Health has been struggling to rebound from the decline it experienced after curtailing many non-urgent business operations during the COVID-19 pandemic. Well, you've been listening to the Chris Business Hour from the Bear Cave. I'm Barry Slater. Thanks for listening. Have a great day, and thank you for letting me give you the business.